Reported hearing a gunshot, and when I got here, I saw the poor guy lying beside his car. Marie looked across to where the body of Christopher Keyes still lay on the concrete. Was he in exactly the same position as he is now?
Pretty much, yes. The medics didn't disturb him much.
He looked at Marie.
Why, Sarge?
I was trying to work out the trajectory of the bullet, but I guess we need forensics to calculate that. They'll be accurate, I'd be only guessing.
Kevin looked at the body and then the surrounding buildings.
I would guess from there.
He pointed to an old warehouse to the left of the theatre. It was a crumbling red brick affair with a series of tiny windows in rows.
It's empty.
Apparently there's been a bit of a bun fight going on between landowners and developers. They wanted to convert it into swanky flats, but there are problems.
Kevin was probably right. If the building was empty, that made it all the more likely. It corresponded to the location of the wound, unless the guy had spun around with the impact.
How about the CCTV coverage?
She asked.
We've already put in a request for it,
Kevin said.
There were two private security cameras operated from the theatre. They had a bit of bother a while back with drug dealers in the car park, so they upgraded the system. Hopefully we should get some good footage.
He looked around the car park.
This is the work of a sniper, isn't it, Sarge?
A single kill shot.
And Christopher Keyes was the suspected hit-and-run driver in the Kirsty Harcourt inquiry.
Kevin gave a low whistle. And her father owns a gun club. Jeez, this is looking nasty.
You can say that again.
We have to keep an open mind, I suppose, but even so, I'm not looking forward to talking to Kenneth Harcourt.
Rather you than me, Kevin said fervently.
Ah, but it'll be you soon enough, eh? Marie smiled at him. I believe congratulations are in order. You've passed your entry examinations to join CID.
Besides being good-looking and with a ready smile, Kevin Stoner was also compassionate. Marie had worked with him on several occasions and had been impressed by his aptitude. For years now, Jackman had been pressing him to try for CID, but Kevin had insisted that he wanted to get more experience on the streets first. Now it seemed he was finally ready.
Yes, Sarge. I'm starting as a pool detective next week. I hope I'm up to it. It will seem really weird ditching the uniform.
He looked almost apologetic.
You'll get used to it, Kev. Just remember that warrant card in your pocket. You're still a policeman, uniform or not.
It'd be like starting all over again, doing all the crap jobs to begin with, just like a rookie PC.
You'll love it, Kevin. You've got what it takes, both Jackman and I are sure of that.
Marie was amused to see Kevin Stoner blush.
Thanks, Sarge. That means a lot. I'll do my very best, I promise.
He looked up.
But there's your boss calling you.
He pointed in Jackman's direction. Marie hurried off, calling back.
Will you let me know directly about the CCTV?
Will do, Sarge.
Ruth Crook is not a happy bunny. Jackman looked harassed.
Marie raised an eyebrow.
Did you expect her to be?
No, but she's particularly vitriolic this time.
Considering you're her favourite officer, that's worrying. Marie pulled a face.
She kept hammering home the warning to tread very, very carefully with Harcourt. He may have been polite to us, but he's no lover of the police. He lost his only daughter, and we couldn't find anyone to put in the dock for it.
Understandable. So, what's the plan now? How do we proceed? Marie asked. Jackman was watching a group of officers in protective suits erecting a tent over the victim and his car.
Forensics first. We need to know what make of gun was used here. If it was an Anschutz supermatch bolt-action rifle, then the shit will hit the fan with considerable force, and soon.
I'll remember to duck. Could a target rifle kill, sir? I don't know a thing about firearms, as you've probably guessed by now.
Jackman smiled. If you were hitting something vital, even a BB rifle could kill. All guns, even air pistols, have lethal potential.
I always knew I hated them, Marie growled.
Me too.
Jackman absent-mindedly massaged the scar where he'd been shot.
Yep, me too.
With very good reason. Marie touched his arm gently. Let's change the subject. Scene of crime officers are here.
She raised a hand and waved.
I can see Ella Jarvis unloading her camera and equipment.
And our favourite pathologist has turned out as well. Professor Rory Wilkinson's Citroen has just arrived.
I'm amazed that old thing is still roadworthy, Maria exclaimed.
Are you talking about Rory or Dolly the Lime Green Mean Machine?
Jackman was lightening up a bit.
Good.
Marie grinned at him.
Don't let Rory hear you talking like that. He'll get an even bigger complex about losing his boyish good looks.
He's got Spike with him too, Jackman commented. He doesn't often let that young man out in public.
It was true. Rory usually worked alone, leaving Spike, his number one technician, in charge of the mortuary.
Hello, cherubs!
The Home Office pathologist greeted them with an angelic smile.
This makes a refreshing change. Mind you, having just returned from a grueling fortnight with D.I. Nicky Galina in Greenborough, I'm starting to wonder if you lot aren't in some kind of local derby. You know, who can notch up the most deaths?
He peered at them over his wire-rimmed glasses.
If you are, then I'm sorry to say that my money is on Nicky this month.
Jackman smiled at their friend.
She's welcome, and long may we be the losers.
He glanced at Spike.
What did you do to get a taste of freedom? Is it your birthday?
Rory smiled benignly.
Dear boy was looking so pasty. He doesn't get out much, you know. I thought a bit of a treat was called for.
Very funny. Now tell them the truth, Puff. Spike stared at him pointedly.
If I must. Actually, dear Spike is moving ahead, forensically speaking. He's making a study of ballistic trauma and gunshot wound trajectory analysis, using forensic animation to establish the relative positions of both shooter and victim.
He took a deep breath.
Did I get that right, Spike?
To perfection, Prof.
Now, can we go and look at the crime scene?
It's all yours, dear boy. I'm but a humble spectator today.
Rory watched his protege march confidently up to the cordon and pull on his zoot suit. He's turned into a damn good technician, and it's time he moved on. I'll miss him, but that's life, isn't it? Nothing stays the same forever. He gave a little sigh, then added,
But tell him that, and you could finish up on my dissecting table.
Marie grinned.
As if we'd dare.
Rory turned to the matter at hand.
Anything special you need from us regarding this unfortunate victim?
First and foremost, the type of gun used.
Jackman went on to mention the recent gun thefts.
Ah, you are looking for a connection.
It's vital, Rory,
Jackman said softly.
We need either to rule out one particular gun or start making very difficult and delicate inquiries.
Well, at least your request is a simple one this time. I'll put you out of your misery just as soon as we remove the bullet, assuming, of course, that it's still in situ.
He gave a little laugh.
Bullets do the strangest things sometimes. Do you know they can even ricochet off the skull and leave the body entirely?
There was an exit wound, Rory. I saw the blood pooling beneath him, said Jackman. So we'll need to find the bullet.
Fear not, dear heart. Spike is on the case, and he's as happy as a pig in chiffon. I'm sure we'll get the answers you need very quickly.
Will you ring me as soon as you have any news?
Jackman glanced at his watch.
We'd better get back.
Of course. Now I have Billy the Kid working the case with me. We should be in touch by later this afternoon. Now run along, you two. Your young victim is safe with me.
They walked back up the lane.
I hate this bit, said Marie. The waiting for forensic reports.
You should be used to it by now, said Jackman.
He climbed in and did up his safety belt.
At least this took place off the beaten track and was a single death, not some drug-crazed kid with a scrambled brain prowling down the high street with an automatic weapon.
Thank God for our gun laws,
Marie added, getting into the car.
Sure, there have been massacres like Dunblane and Hungerford, but thankfully otherwise they're rare in the UK.
She started the car.
The press didn't take long to turn up, did they?
I don't want some smart young hack making the connection between Keyes and Harcourt before we're ready with some answers.
Jackman drew his brow together in a worried frown.
We have to keep a lid on the victim's identity, at least until we know about the type of gun used.
Marie pulled out into the main road.
We'll cope, sir. And hopefully, with Billy the Kid on the case, we won't have to wait too long.
Chapter 5.
It's a what?
Jackman said.
Well, from the kind of bullet and the distance between the sniper and the target, I reckon we're looking at something like an L-11 5A3 sniper rifle, which is used by the British Army, Royal Air Force and the Royal Marines, D.R. Jackman.
Spike sounded very sure of himself. This raised a whole lot of further questions, but at least it wasn't one of the guns stolen from Kenneth Harcourt.
A military weapon, murmured Jackman.
Absolutely, sir. A long-range bolt-action rifle used by British Special Forces, Spike confirmed. The longest recorded kill shot was made using one of those when a British Army sniper took out two Taliban machine gunners from a distance of over 2,700 yards.
That's 1.5 miles.
Impressive, innit?
How on earth would someone get hold of one of those? Jackman said.
Oh, they're not just military. You can purchase them for hunting and some civilian long-distance competition target shooters like to use them. And it's British, Spike added proudly. A Portsmouth-based company produce them. The firm was started by an Olympic gold medalist in shooting.
Okay. So what would one of those set me back? Asked Jackman.
Spike didn't take a breath.
£23,000.
Jackman whistled.
Whew, that much.
These are the bee's knees, sir. If I was into shooting, I'd be very happy to own one of those.
Jackman's brain was going into overdrive. For some reason, he had been certain that the stolen target rifle was going to be the culprit. Now he knew otherwise, he was still concerned that Harcourt was connected to the killing. He owned a gun club, ergo he had access to all sorts of weapons, so why not a sniper rifle?
Spike, do you have any idea of where the shooter was standing when he fired the shot?
Certainly have, D.R. Jackman. I notified Uniform immediately. They're checking it out right now. From the angle of the entry wound, the trajectory was pretty clear. It was from the roof of the department store just beyond that derelict warehouse. It has a customer car park up there, connected to the multi-story council one next door.
Jackman knew the place. The top floor of the car park was only used on busy market days when traffic was heavy. It was some distance away, but made the perfect spot for a marksman, having an unobstructed view of the theatre car park.
I guess a sharpshooter would have no trouble at all, especially with the telescopic lenses they have on them,
Spike added. Would have been child's play for a crack shot.
Thanks, Spike. I really appreciate your expertise on this.
Tell that to the prof when you've got a minute, will you, sir? Spike laughed. Anything else we come up with, we'll contact you.
Jackman hung up and beckoned to Marie. While he waited for her to join him, he closed his eyes and tried to think. Marie hurried in and shut the door behind her.
Can we sum up where we are, sir? I need to get my head around all this.
One dead male, name of Christopher Keyes, executed by a sniper using a military weapon from some distance away. On the roof of Burridge's department store, to be exact. Keyes was suspected of driving the car that killed Kirsty Harcourt. Her father, Kenneth, owns guns and runs a gun club. Plus, he's known to be angry and resentful that no one was made to pay for his daughter's death.
Marie grunted. Looks like we're going to have that difficult conversation after all.
Oh, well. I suggest we grab a coffee, see what Uniform have found up on the car park roof, then go and visit Harcourt again. At very least, he has to be notified about Keyes' death, Jackman said.
What about Chris Keyes' family, sir? Have they been notified yet?
Marie asked. Robbie and Rosie have already gone to speak to them. We need his next of kin to formally identify him, and then we can proceed. He checked the time. They've been gone for a while, so we should hear from them soon. Marie left to get their drinks, and Jackman realized that over 2 hours had passed without his having a single thought of Alistair Ashcroft. All their plans of getting out there and making inquiries about him were suddenly on hold. Naturally, the shooting came first, but Jackman was very aware that Ashcroft would really enjoy making a move while they were trying to deal with a murder. Robbie phoned.
It's in, boss. It's Christopher Keyes. His father came to the morgue with us and made the ID.
How are the family holding up?
Jackman asked.
We've left them with a family liaison officer, sir. We had no one immediately available, so Greenborough have sent us Sergeant Lucy Wells, and she's looking after them.
They are all in shock, as you can imagine. The mother is devastated.
Robbie sounded pretty strung out himself. Notifying relatives was one of the more harrowing aspects of police work. Get yourselves back here, Robbie.
Yes, sir. Oh, before I go, we asked if they knew why Christopher was in that particular car park. His father said he always parked there on a Thursday. He had a part-time job at the theatre. His killer obviously knew that.
Okay. Good work, Robbie. Now you and Rosie come back. Get yourself some strong coffee and take a break.
We have a positive ID?
Marie placed a steaming mug of coffee on his desk. Confirmed. It is Keys. His phone rang again, and he heard the deep voice of the desk sergeant. No evidence found upon the car park roof, sir, but the cameras have been tampered with. One was turned aside and another was covered in some kind of sticky-back plastic. We've spoken to the security staff at Burridge's and they say no one drove onto the roof at the time of the incident. The area you mentioned, the one where the cameras were tampered with, does it give a view of the theatre, Sergeant? Oh, yes, sir. Clear view. And he most likely parked on one of the lower levels with all the other cars and walked up. That's what we thought, sir, so we're going over the CCTV for the whole car park from the time it opened to the approximate time of the attack. Thanks, Sergeant. Keep me posted. Will do. Jackman stared into his coffee. Marie, do you honestly believe that Kenneth Harcourt is the kind of person who would have a young man executed in cold blood? Marie drew in a long breath.
Well, sir, we don't know the family, do we? If he was the kind of father who idolized his only daughter, maybe it's possible. But my problem with that scenario is that there were two suspects. If Keyes was indisputably the driver, and we simply hadn't got enough concrete evidence to put him away, I'd understand it. But that wasn't the case. She sipped her coffee. Or maybe if Keyes had been heard bragging about getting away with it in the pub or somewhere, that would also cause Harcourt to want to kill him. But Keyes always denied being the driver, she shrugged. We need to know more about the Harcourt family and their relationships with each other. But on the surface, I say no, I don't think he is.
I'm of the same opinion, Jackman said. The act was premeditated. Whoever killed Keyes was cold and callous, and Harcourt doesn't come across like that. Even so, I'd be interested to know where he was at the time of the shooting. We mustn't forget the man is an expert shot.
Plus he's ex-army, which means that he mixes with like-minded people, said Murray. He didn't have to pull the trigger himself, did he? He's a well-off bloke. He could have hired an assassin to do his dirty work for him. Jackman knew it would not be the first time that a grieving parent or loved one had taken the law into their own hands.
Maybe.
I'm still uneasy about three crimes all happening one after the other and all being connected to Harcourt in some way. Marie screwed her face up in concentration. The gun club break-in. Then Harcourt has his own house broken into and guns stolen. Now a man connected to the death of Kirsty, his daughter, is shot and killed? She shook her head. There has to be something linking all three.
Jackman took a long swallow of his coffee. I think we are going to have to take a close look into the life of Christopher Keyes. I want a clear picture of that young man. What he was like, whether he was trouble or a little saint, everything about him. He was the target, no question. If it has nothing to do with Kirsty Harcourt, then what on earth did he do to get himself murdered?
Good question, Marie drained her mug.
Okay, ready when you are, boss. Wits End. The name sounds about right this time, doesn't it? Charlie Button couldn't wait for the day to end so he could get home and spend an hour in the bath. He still smelt of diesel. The odd thing was, even though there had been a serious crime committed that day, his mind kept wandering back to the balls-up of a job at Dewsbury End Farm. If he still stank of diesel, and he'd only been in contact with the hose they had used to siphon off the fuel, what the hell did they smell like? They must have been covered in the stuff. He wished he had a list of offenders known to commit that kind of crime. A quick visit and a cursory sniff could be quite illuminating. The problem was, all the villains specializing in fuel theft were either banged up or far too good at it to have made such a mess of a job. There were a couple of lads from one of the Fen villages who he suspected might be heading for a life of crime, but it couldn't be them. They were too young to drive, and they would hardly be carrying oil cans on the handlebars of their bikes. As soon as Jackman got back, there would be far more important things to deal with, but all Charlie could think about was the damage done to the environment. If he could only find a few names to call on, he'd even collar the scroats in his own time. The stink of diesel would hang around the perpetrators for days, a dead giveaway. He wasn't being a lone avenger or looking for kudos. He just kept thinking that if the farmer and his lads hadn't acted so quickly, the foul stuff would have contaminated the dikes and ditches and caused untold damage to the wildlife there. Plus, it would have been the devil's own job to clean it up. The stupid little shits needed to be told, and he'd happily be the one to do it. If only he could work out who they were. Then it dawned on him. PC Kevin Stoner. If anyone would know the likely suspects, it was him. Kev knew everyone. He was still at the crime scene in town, but he would be back before Charlie's shift ended. He'd have a quiet word. Charlie Button returned to his reports, doing his best to ignore his mate's comments about the smell. On the way to Wits End, Jackman and Marie formulated a strategy for interviewing Kenneth Harcourt. It wasn't exactly good cop, bad cop, but Jackman was going to take a harsher approach, while Marie would be rather more conciliatory. Yet, as they stood under the elegant portico waiting for someone to answer the door, Marie found her resolve faltering. This was not going to be easy. He was a possible suspect in a murder investigation, but at the same time he was a grieving dad whose only daughter had died needlessly, with no one made to pay for it. Kenneth Harcourt answered the door himself. His expression told them he already knew the reason for their visit. He looked grey and drained.
"It's all over the local news. A man was shot in Salton car park, and my gun was probably the weapon used. Is that what you're thinking? Because I certainly am."
He held the door open for them. They sat in the same seats, in the same room as before, but this was going to be a very different kind of interview.
"I'm afraid it's a little more complex than that, Mr. Harcourt," Jackman began. "The media do not have all the facts. We are here to make you aware of some of them before they become public."
If anything, Harcourt turned even paler. Marie tried hard to look at him dispassionately. After all, he could be this pasty colour because he had killed someone or been instrumental in that death. Her empathy was threatening to cloud her judgment. Luckily, Jackman seemed very much in control. Marie took a deep breath and listened.
"Sir, the young man who was murdered was called Christopher Keyes."
He stopped to allow the name to register, watching Harcourt closely.
"Keyes? Are you sure?"
Harcourt's face was a picture of disbelief and confusion.
"No doubt at all, sir. He's been formally identified by his father."
"My God!"
Marie saw his Adam's apple move jerkily up and down as he swallowed.
"Was it my gun? Oh, dear Lord, was it my target rifle?"
"No, sir," Jackman said flatly. "We can't say for certain yet, but it appears that it was something with the caliber of an L-11-5A3 sniper rifle."
Marie had difficulty trying to disentangle the confusion of mixed emotions that passed across Harcourt's face on hearing this.
"An assault rifle, but..."
"I'm asking you this, sir, because of your expertise with weaponry. Do you know of anyone who might own such a gun? I understand there are competitions for long-distance target shooting. Someone who belongs to your club, maybe."
"Impossible. We don't hold that kind of weapon. Weapons like that are either for the use of the military or elite target competitors who are aiming for medals, not the kind of amateurs that belong to our club. Apart from which, an L-11-5A3 would cost a small fortune."
He paused, stared at Jackman.
"Oh, Lord, I'm a suspect, aren't I?
Because I can shoot and because I always believed Keyes was the driver who killed my Kirsty."
Without answering his question, Marie asked,
Did you have any specific reason to believe that Keyes was the driver, sir?
She kept her voice soft and as non-judgmental as she could.
Nothing we could prove, he sighed. But a friend of Kirsty's told us they had seen Keyes driving that particular car earlier, when they were on their way to football practice.
We are very sorry for your loss, sir, but you can understand why we have to ask you these questions, don't you?
She managed to keep her voice calm.
I'm not a fool, detective, Harcourt said. And if you want to know where I was when this murder took place, ask away.
Marie raised an eyebrow.
So, where were you this afternoon at 14:30 hours?
Right here, waiting in for the mower company to come and collect my ride-on mower. They picked it up at 2:45 exactly. The driver and my wife will verify that.
Jackman made a note of the name of the mower repair company.
So that gun is completely unknown to you? Asked Jackman.
Damn it, man, I've told you that already.
His face coloured briefly.
Marie found this interesting but wasn't sure why. He'd been too quick in his denial.
I'm sorry we have to ask these questions, Mr. Harcourt. Can we rely on your assistance regarding this matter? This is a murder inquiry and we're going to need to interview members of your club. We'll be as discreet as possible, but anyone with a knowledge of guns or their use will have to be spoken to.
Yes, yes, Harcourt said. I'll cooperate as much as I can, but please do be discreet. It's taken years to build up that club. Decent people don't like the thought of being suspected of something so dreadful as murder.
Decent, innocent people have nothing to fear, Jackman added.
Harcourt said nothing.
Can I ask you about Kirsty, sir?
Here we go, Marie said to herself.
If it's not too painful.
Harcourt's expression softened.
She was a handful, all right, no denying it, full of life and headstrong, but she was a great kid.
He swallowed. I know every parent thinks the same of their kids, but Kirsty would have gone places, I know it. She was destined to have a full, exciting life, and it was cut short. I don't think I'll ever get my head around it. The fact that it only takes a split second for a life to change, to be extinguished.
And it changed for the whole family, didn't it?
Marie considered how the sudden death of her own husband had changed everything for many people, not just her.
Her brother's character altered almost overnight, dear Sevens. I hadn't fully appreciated the bond between them, but when she died, it was as if someone had thrown a switch and Jack's light dimmed. He was several years older than Kirsty, but they were very close.
You had just the two children, sir?
Jackman asked.
No, the eldest Aaron is away on a gap year somewhere in the Middle Kingdom, so he says.
His eyes had a distant look.
He doesn't contact us much. It pains his mother, but, he shrugged, I can't force him to talk to us. We hope the travel will sort his head out, then maybe we'll get him back.
Jackman coughed.
Going back to Keyes, sir. Had you known him before the accident? Only you mentioned that Kirsty's friend recognized him.
It was no accident, dear Jackman. It was manslaughter at the very least. But no, we didn't actually know him, other than by sight. It was Kirsty's friend who knew him. He lived a few doors away from her.
I see.
Jackman closed his notebook and stood up.
I think that's all for now, sir. Here's my card. If you hear the slightest whisper about that gun, please phone me immediately.
Harcourt took the card and stared at it.
You aren't related to Lawrence Jackman, are you?
My father, Mr. Harcourt.
Well, give him my best, won't you? We'd go back a long way.
Jackman gave him a tight smile.
I'll be sure to do that, sir.
As soon as the door closed behind them, Jackman sighed loudly.
Is there anyone my father doesn't know?
Marie laughed.
That's what comes of being a tough boss. You know all the best people.
And murder suspects.
Seriously, sir, you really think Harcourt might have done it?
There's something about him that is ringing alarm bells, Marie. At the very least, there's something he's not telling us. Or else he knows a hell of a lot more than he's letting on.
Body language?
Jackman frowned.
Not exactly. I need to think about it.
And I had that odd thing about his gun collection yesterday. If we both feel there's something not quite right about him, we should dig deeper.
Jackman was silent on the drive back to town. Marie guessed his thoughts were on Harcourt. Marie, on the other hand, had turned her mind to Alistair Ashcroft. Forever in my thoughts. What an odd choice of words. Well, he was certainly in hers. More than anything, she wanted to hear her voice reading him his rights. The photograph of Jackman and herself outside the Nick troubled her. All that time he had been spying on them, and they had never known. It made her shiver. Superintendent Ruth Crook had taken Ashcroft's threat extremely seriously. She certainly didn't need reminding of the hell his last reign of terror had put them through. Security at the police station had been beefed up, the CCTV cameras checked several times a day, and the dog handler with Stan, his furry exocet, patrolled the perimeters. People going in and out of the busy station were being vetted carefully, and just driving back through the security gates, Marie sensed the heightened tension in the air. Strangely, Jackman seemed oblivious to it. He was spending a lot of time in his head today and not sharing his thoughts with Marie. This was unlike him and had unsettled her. Once or twice she had caught him staring at her with a peculiar, rather haunted look on his face. After everything they had been through together, she and Jackman were close, sharing an unspoken affinity and a bond that went beyond mere camaraderie. This meant that each was very sensitive to the other's moods and states of mind. "Everything okay, boss?" Marie asked tentatively. Jackman, closing the car door, stared at her.
"Sorry, I was miles away then."
"I'll see. So is it Harcourt or Ashcroft?" He gave her a sheepish smile.
"Both, actually."
"Then let's get inside, and Auntie Marie will make you a nice coffee. The nearest the Fenland Constabulary can get to one anyway."
"I'll take you up on that, Auntie. Extra sugar today, please."
But Jackman's attempt at a smile was unconvincing. Marie guessed it was the thought of Ashcroft's return. Jackman was frightened for her and the team and probably their families. It was understandable, but worrying too. If they were to catch Ashcroft, they had to have a strong and inspiring leader. Jackman was the perfect man for the job, but these fears of his would undermine him. If it came to a struggle between a man who cared too much versus a man who cared about nothing, the former would lose. Chapter 6. Jackman and Marie had missed the 4 o'clock meeting, but the whole team was still in the CID room. Gary Pritchard, who had gone to talk to Chris Key's parents, looked preoccupied.
"Fill us in, Gary," said Jackman, taking a spare chair next to Marie.
"Not the happiest experience, as you can imagine, sir. I'm not sure how officers like Lucy Wells can do that sort of thing all day, every day," he sighed. "Basically, Christopher, aged 24, was one of three siblings, two boys and a girl. All were living at home. He'd never been in trouble prior to the incident involving Kirsty Harcourt. He had a decent job with a local double glazing company until it closed a few months ago, and recently he'd been doing several part-time jobs, including working at the theatre."
"Happy family life?" asked Jackman.
"Pretty average, I'd say, boss. Not well off, but they were managing. The Harcourt investigation obviously caused them a great deal of distress. Oh, and the teenage girl has some sort of developmental problems, which is another source of worry."
"Did the family give an indication of what they believe had happened when Kirsty died?" asked Marie.
"We didn't get into too much detail, Sarge. They were well cut up and it was all pretty fraught. The mother swears he was not even in the car at the time, but then I suppose she would. He never came up with a proper alibi, so..." Gary shrugged. "We'll most likely never know. Lucy mentioned to me that the little sister did say something rather odd."
Jackman looked at him.
"Oh?"
"Lucy suspects she has a form of autism. She lacks certain social skills. She has no consideration for others' sensibilities. You know, can't tell a white lie.
What? Like if someone asked her, 'Does my bum look big in this?' she'd probably answer, 'Yes, bloody massive,'"
asked Charlie Button.
"Nicely put, Charlie. Lucy managed to talk to the girl and her older brother and asked them about Chris and the accident. Apparently, she said, 'How should I know when I wasn't there?
but he was driving the car a lot that day because his best friend had been ditched by his girlfriend and was drunk. Do you think they'll let me have Chris's room now? He's gone. It's bigger than mine.
Phew, Marie let out a breath. Plain speaking like that must be hard to live with.
And it rather indicates that his mate might have been the hit-and-run driver and Chris was protecting him by not speaking up, said Jackman thoughtfully. Still, as Gary had said, they might never know for sure.
Thanks, Gary. Now, anything else before we call it a day?
He looked around. No response.
Then I suggest you all head off home. We'll start early tomorrow, and I don't have to tell you all to be vigilant. Anything out of the ordinary, anything bothering any of you, please shout. Ashcroft is here somewhere, so be on your guard and stay safe.
He stood up. Now, bugger off home.
Charlie Button collected his things, but instead of leaving, made his way downstairs to the back office.
Is Kev around?
He asked the gathered officers.
Saw his car pulling in a few moments ago, one of them said.
Charlie went out to the reception and saw Kevin talking to his sergeant. He waited until they had finished and called to him.
Kev, I need a favour.
Kevin Stoner grinned at him. Better be quick because I'm coming upstairs next week, joining you lot.
I heard, that's really great.
Charlie clapped him on the shoulder.
Well done.
Thanks, mate.
So, what's the problem?
Asked Kevin.
Charlie explained his dilemma. Kevin had to think about it.
I know a couple of idiots that are more than capable of messing up a caper like that. I'll pay them a call and let you know, okay?
Jackman watched them all leave, and the anxiety began to build again. He knew what Ashcroft was capable of. He and those he loved had been on the receiving end of Ashcroft's evil tactics in the past, and now he had all the more reason to worry. For the first time, he had a personal life, and it was precious to him. He had come to realize that he wasn't quite the loner he had believed he was. He had always considered himself to be a solitary soul, living for his work and destined to end his days alone in Mill Corner with a horse and a couple of dogs. Now he had Laura. He was happy. He had plans. One of them being the renovation of the old mill. His only regret was that Marie was still alone. She had once told him that she was still married to Bill, her husband who had died, and she would have felt she was being unfaithful if she formed a relationship with anyone else. That was sad. If only his friend would allow herself to be happy again. Jackman wondered if he should go and check in with Ruth Crook before he left, then decided that he'd leave it till morning. Mrs. Maynard, his daily help, had promised to leave them one of her special cottage pies, and after this awful day, all he wanted was to eat some home-cooked food, drink a glass of wine with Laura, and shut out the world. Marie coasted into her driveway, killed the engine and patted the tank of her lovely new bike. This beauty was the most expensive and exciting motorcycle she'd ever owned, and Marie was proud of her. After Ashcroft's attack on her, in which Harvey had been trashed, she had considered lighter, sportier models, but after she'd recovered from her injuries, she made up her mind to treat herself. She had chosen an adventure bike, built for both off- and on-road riding. She had finally opted for a Triumph, a Tiger 12 XRT in scarlet and black, and she could not have been happier with it. She pulled off her helmet and shook out her long dark brown hair. Should she take advantage of the beautiful evening and go for a ride? After a hard day, the speed and freedom were a tonic. The exhilaration cleared her mind. Leaving the bike on the drive, she went inside to check for messages, make herself a quick cup of tea, and then decide whether to go back out or not. A message from her mother. Marie smiled. She always looked forward to talking with her mother. She took her favourite mug, the one bearing the motto, "Only bikers understand why dogs stick their heads out of car windows," made her tea, and took it through to her conservatory. Her mother answered almost immediately.
"Hello, darling. I've been thinking about you all day. How is everything?"
She always knew when Marie was worried or having a bad day.
We've had a murder here in town. A man was shot.
And are you working the case?
Marie always found her mother's attempt at police speak amusing.
Yes, Mum. Jackman is SIO. Our team is investigating.
There was a slight pause. Marie knew exactly what was coming next.
There's something else too, isn't there?
Her mum always knew.
Yes, Mum. We've had a message from Alistair Ashcroft. Nothing specific. He's just letting us know he's still around.
I see.
Marie, should I come up for a few days?
There's nothing I'd like more, but not now. I'd be terrified all the time about you being here alone.
Ah, but I wouldn't be alone. You see, I now have Lloyd.
Marie screwed up her forehead in puzzlement.
Lloyd? Lloyd who? Doesn't have a surname. Lloyd is a German shepherd dog, darling. His owner had to go into a nursing home after a long illness, and he had no one to take him in.
Besides working tirelessly for a dozen charities, her mother made time for anyone who needed her. Despite all she did, her mother spent a lot of time alone, and if not, in the company of the homeless and the addicted, and Marie worried about how vulnerable she was. A large dog was a very good thing to have by your side.
Good for you, Mum.
So, what about that visit? I think it's about time, don't you?
I'd love to say yes, Mum. But if you had the dog and an SAS team surrounding you, I'd still be shit scared of letting you out of my sight. Let's make a date for as soon as we've nailed this psycho.
Consider me unconvinced, but I'll let it go for tonight.
She paused.
Just ring me every day. I haven't forgotten what happened to you last time. You're my only daughter and I need to know you're safe.
I promise. Although I can't say what time it'll be, I'm afraid.
Of course, no problem. I just need to hear your voice. And your voice, Marie. None of those text thingies.
Received and understood, Mum.
Good. Now, I'm off to feed my new baby. Night-night, my darling.
As Marie set the phone back into its cradle, something dropped through the letterbox. Junk mail, probably. She went to the front door and saw a plain white envelope lying on the mat. The warm feeling that her mother's call had given her was instantly replaced with disquiet. Her chest tightened. She bent down and opened it. Another photo, again of her and Jackman, this time sitting in a car in town. There was no message. Marie dropped the picture and flung the door open. There, legging it up the road, was the lanky figure of a youth. She ran after him. He turned the corner at the bottom of the road and headed for a lane that led to the village green. Marie was in good shape, but he was young and remarkably fast. Even so, after a few minutes, she began to gain on him. All at once, he veered to the side and headed straight for a high fence. As he leapt, Marie grabbed at his jacket. For a moment, she thought she'd had him. But he slipped out of her grasp, leaving her holding a grubby sleeveless hoodie, while he scrambled over the fence and was gone. Out of breath, Marie trudged slowly back to her house. At least he hadn't damaged her new bike. Then she noticed something that hadn't been there before. Dangling from the hand grip was a small wreath of artificial flowers. She peered at it without touching it. A handwritten card was attached. It read, "Lest we forget." Marie heaved in a deep breath. It would probably be a waste of time and money, but she called in and asked for Socco to be dispatched to her address. It was the second communication from Ashcroft in one day. She couldn't ignore it. It would appear the bastard really meant business this time. She stood outside her home, staring at that silly, sinister plastic wreath, and made another call.
Gary, remember what you asked me this afternoon? Well, I've had a change of heart.
Chapter 7. Gary hung up, went straight to his bedroom and took a small suitcase from the top of his wardrobe. He filled it with enough off-duty clothes to tide him over for a couple of nights, plus a few personal bits, and checked that all his windows were shut. He was ready to go in 20 minutes. He could sort out what to take for a longer stay after he'd talked to Marie.
He had gathered from her call that she was more angry than frightened. The two of them together would have had a better chance of catching Ashcroft's messenger boy. No matter what her reason, Gary was glad she had turned to him. He had hated thinking of her alone in her house with that murdering psycho in the neighborhood. He locked up and put his things in his car. Marie only lived 5 minutes away on the other side of Sutterthorpe Village, so rather than drive straight to her house, he decided to cruise around the village, keeping a lookout for fugitive youths. The bus shelter and the churchyard, both favorite haunts, were empty. Seeing no one suspicious, he headed for Marie's place. When he arrived, he found a lone socko, a new lad called Thomas Keane, carefully dusting her front door for prints. The motorcycle was still on the drive, the garland of artificial flowers decorating the handlebars. Marie came out to meet him.
"I appreciate this, Gary."
"Rubbish. You only asked me because you got fed up of your own cooking." He grinned at her, then added, "You're okay, though, really."
"I'm just so mad at that son of a bitch. The thought of him watching Jackman and me snapping pictures of us, it's an intrusion."
"Journalists do it for a living."
"They aren't planning on killing anyone," she retorted. "Come on in. Thomas has got a bit to do yet." I suddenly realized that the letterbox is quite stiff and my postie always has to lift the flap to get my mail through. Thomas said there's a nice big thumbprint on the underside, so hopefully our delivery boy will be known to us.
They went through to the kitchen and Marie made tea. I gave the village a quick recce on the way over, but there were no suspicious-looking little beggars around. I'm betting he's long gone. He was like a whippet, went over that bloody great fence like a rat up a drainpipe. I stood no chance.
"But you got his jacket, that's brilliant," Gary said.
"Thomas has it all bagged up. He'll take it back to the lab with his samples. If we've ever collared that lad before, we should get a match."
Gary nodded. "If we get him in an interview room and put the frighteners on him, he might be a lead to Ashcroft." Marie looked doubtful.
"I'm not so sure about that. Ashcroft's clever. He'll get some street kid to do his dirty work, pay him, and move on to the next hard-up teenager. I doubt they see him more than twice, and don't forget, Ashcroft loves his disguises."
"I suppose so, but that jacket could be important."
Marie handed him a mug of tea. "I think I must have always known this day would come because I've kept your room made up and ready. You can take your stuff up there any time you like. Have you eaten yet?" He shook his head.
"Hadn't got that far."
"Fish and chips, when Thomas is finished?" she asked.
"Smashing. I'll go and pick some up." The village didn't have much by way of amenities, but like so many Lincolnshire villages and small towns, it had a cracking chippy.
"I've got a better idea. We'll go and eat there," Marie said. "My treat."
It wasn't a big shop, but it did have a small cafe out the back, where a fish supper with mushy peas, scraps and bread and butter, plus a giant mug of tea, cost little more than a takeaway.
"I need to do something normal, something ordinary, like eating a big plate of haddock and chips with a good friend. Something that has nothing to do with crime, subterfuge or death," Marie declared.
"Sounds perfect," Gary said. "Talking to the Keyes family earlier, Farah rung me out. I could do with a large helping of the commonplace too."
"We have to order place in advance," Marie said.
"Very droll." He sipped his tea, suddenly pensive. "How do we cope, Marie? I wonder sometimes. It could be a shitty job."
"If you could go back to the start, knowing what you know now, would you do it all again?" Marie asked.
He didn't answer immediately. After a while, he said, "I would, because I'd never believed that the bad bits could be so awful. But I definitely wouldn't go to Harland Marsh. That place and some other people who worked there drains your very soul. You and Jackman were the saving of me. I was just about to throw it all in when you turned up and got me transferred to Salton."
"You're a good copper, Gary. Jackman appreciates that. Our team wouldn't be the same without you."
He flushed with pride.
"How about you?"
"Without a doubt. It's in my blood," Marie said. "I've always known this was what I was cut out for, and I've never had the slightest doubt that I'm in the right job."
They sat drinking tea, each lost in their own thoughts. Then Gary said, "Did that lad look familiar? Like one of our regular troublemakers?" "I only saw the back of him, but no, I can't say I recognized him at all." Marie paused, thinking. "He was just a scruffy kid with slightly straggly dark hair, faded jeans, battered trainers, and a sweaty stained camouflage T-shirt."
"Pretty good description. Shall I circulate it?" he asked.
"Already done. After I rang you, I called it into uniform. Not that I'm expecting them to find him. He'll have gone to ground. And I nearly had him, the little toe rag."
"Have you phoned Jackman, Marie?"
She bit her lip. No, not yet."
"Marie, why? He'll skin you alive if he finds out about this from someone else."
It wasn't like the Sarge. She and Jackman operated in tandem, always. What was up? He leaned forward. "Okay, lady, spill the beans." Marie put down her mug with a groan.
"I will ring him, but... oh, he seems so over-anxious about our safety. I wanted to spare him more worry. Let him have a night's sleep without imagining all sorts of horrifying scenarios."
"I think he has every right to be anxious, don't you? He's the one with the responsibility. We are his team, and if anything happens to any of us, the blame will fall on his shoulders."
"It's not just that, Gary. But all day he's been acting oddly, even before Ashcroft raised his head. I've caught him looking at me as if he'd been told I had a terminal illness. Frankly, it unnerved me."
"I wouldn't know about that, but you really should talk to him, Marie. Play it down by all means and tell him I'm here with you, but fill him in, for heaven's sake."
He looked towards the house phone.
"Go on, do it now, and then we can have our supper in peace."
"Okay, but only if you do me a favour and watch him tomorrow, will you? I'd value your opinion in case I've turned neurotic all of a sudden."
"It's a deal."
Gary couldn't help hearing Marie inform Jackman of what had happened. She kept it as light as possible, assuring him that Gary was with her and apologizing for not contacting him sooner. She listened a while and put the receiver down.
"That was tricky, Gary. But it's done now. I never knew you were such a good liar, Sarge."
"I should be. I've mixed with some class acts over the past 2 decades, haven't I?" she said dryly.
"Sergeant Evans, I'm just about through here," Thomas called from the hallway. "You might want to put that awesome bike somewhere safe for the night."
"Dead right. She's going under lock and key, don't you worry." She went to the door.
"Did you get anything useful, Thomas?"
"Oh, there's a fair bit of stuff there, but that thumbprint is a corker. I'll get the lab to ring you tomorrow."
He gathered up his aluminium cases and carried them to his car.
"We'll pay a special attention to that hoodie, Sarge. There may be a hair with a follicle on it that could give us DNA.
"Thanks, Thomas. Much appreciated."
Maria watched him go, and then turned back to Gary.
"Right, I'll put the bike away. Then we can act like ordinary people for a bit."
"Perfect." Kevin Stoner, now in civvies, walked slowly along Water Lane, a wide pathway running alongside a straight deep drain. To a stranger, this might have looked like a well-kept river, but the fens were crisscrossed with waterways like this one, most man-made. Water Lane led from the outskirts of Salton Town to a large expanse of waste ground. There had been great excitement when it was rumoured that a major player was buying this piece of land to build a supermarket, but the project had fallen through, and it had been left to become overgrown and desolate. The walls between the open space and the railway track were now daubed with graffiti, and the place served as a sort of park where teenagers and kids on BMXs could gather. They had even tried to set up part of it for skateboards, though this looked a bit hazardous to Kevin. Not a place to visit alone, at night. It was also fast becoming a haunt of dropouts and drug dealers. Kevin was hoping to see a guy named William. He wasn't exactly a snout, but he was often open to supplying a little information for the price of a bottle of cider. All Kevin needed were a few names of people who might have cooked up the bungled fuel theft job. He liked Charlie Button and was keen to give the lad a hand to track the diesel thieves.
He found William sitting with a couple of other rough sleepers outside the ruins of an old storehouse close to the railway line. He knew most of them by name, or at least recognized them. But tonight he noticed a new face in their ranks. Kevin had come prepared, with a pocketful of chocolate bars. The stranger, a guy of around 40, Kevin supposed, snatched the chocolate from him, ripped the foil wrapper off and pushed the lot into his mouth. Kevin took careful note of his appearance for future reference. He was of medium build, stocky, with brown wavy hair, a dark complexion and a single earring in his left earlobe. From the state of his clothes, he had not been on the streets long. Kevin noted the grey and red rucksack that he kept very close to him. William nodded in the man's direction.
"Calls himself Barney."
Addressing the newcomer, he said,
"Kevin's okay, understand? He's all right."
Barney's brown eyes were frightened, distrustful. Another sign that he was no seasoned street dweller. Kevin stuck out his hand, but the man shrank back.
"William, got 5 minutes?"
"Got all the time in the world, Governor." He stood up.
"Want to take a walk around my country estate?"
They sauntered across to where a group of youngsters were gathered round their bikes listening to hip-hop on a mobile phone. Kevin took a fiver from his pocket and handed it surreptitiously to William.
"Wondered if you'd heard any rumours on the street about someone nicking red diesel and getting a blowback from the tank. Real mess, apparently. Total car crash of a job. Sort of thing the pros would have a right laugh over."
William pocketed the money and gave a short laugh.
"There's an art to carrying off that kind of racket. All the guys that I've come across are smarter than that. They can drain a tank and be away before you even know they were there. Ask around for me, Will. I'll come back tomorrow evening."
"With another fiver?" William asked.
"Find me a name, and it'll be more than that. I'll see what I can do."
For a while, they watched the kids scorching around the waste ground on their bikes, doing wheelies and yelling to each other. Then Kevin asked,
"How long has Barney been here? Looks like a rabbit caught in the headlights."
3 days, Kev, but he's told us nothing about himself."
William stared across the scrubby area at the slowly setting sun.
"Lovely, ain't it? Even over a dump like this, it's still beautiful."
Kevin knew that William was a bit of a street poet. Circumstances had made him homeless, but he had kept his dignity and often showed a very sensitive side, especially where the natural world was concerned. Then he abruptly added,
"But he's scared shitless about something. I know that much."
His words called a halt to Kevin's musings over William's virtues.
"I thought that too, but it must be pretty daunting landing here if you aren't used to it."
William shook his head.
"Nah, it's not that. It's something else. I'll find out soon enough, though. I always do. Now, officer, anything else I can do for you? Just stay safe, Will, that's all."
They walked back to the old store, where the little group were pulling sleeping bags and blankets together into temporary beds for the night. Kevin observed that Barney was still clutching his rucksack to him.
"Poor guy. It's bad enough finding yourself homeless, but to be terrified as well."
Shadows were starting to form. The music had fallen silent. The young bikers were leaving their makeshift park. Kevin could hear a blackbird somewhere.
"Night, guys. See you again," he called out.
"Night, Barney. Good to meet you." The man stood straighter, tentatively lifted a hand in a wave or a salute. As he did so, there was a sharp crack. Everyone froze, looking around in confusion. The man who called himself Barney went over backwards, hit the ground, and lay still. Kevin leapt forward, yelling to the others to get down and out of the line of fire. He threw himself down next to Barney and saw instantly that there would be no saving him. A bullet had torn a ragged hole in his head. Immediately he was on his phone and calling for assistance. By the time he'd finished the frantic call, he was alone with the dead man. The others had melted away into the gathering darkness.
Suddenly the waste ground was no longer a place where a beautiful sunset could still be appreciated, but was full of threat and menace. His fear began to mount. Was the sniper still out there? Was Kevin in his sights? Throat dry and palms sweaty, Kevin inched back into the ruined store and took cover. In the distance, the noise of two tones ripped the twilight apart. The station was only minutes away, but those minutes were very long. He found that he was shaking. Shock. It had happened so fast. The gesture the man had made was etched indelibly in his mind. Every time he closed his eyes, he saw the hand half raised. It looked like a farewell. Two deaths. Two shootings. Both discovered by him, and one had happened right in front of his eyes. Was this what he had signed up for? Blue lights were approaching, sirens wailing. Kevin blinked back tears of relief. He crept away from the ruined building and crouched over poor, homeless Barney. Automatically, he started to raise his hand to his fellow officers, then recalled that final gesture of Barney's. He brought his hand down quickly and called out, "Over here!" Now, men and women were running towards him. He saw faces he recognized, and then someone was throwing a foil blanket around his shoulders.
"Come on, mate, let's get you out of here. I think you've had enough for one day."
His sergeant propelled him towards an ambulance that was joining the other emergency vehicles.
"Let these guys look after you, and we'll talk later."
Kevin opened his mouth, but no sound came out. All he could see was Barney's lifted hand, and all he could hear was a blackbird singing and the crack of a sniper rifle.
Chapter 8. Laura Archer looked out of the kitchen window. Jackman, silhouetted, stood motionless beneath the imposing hulk of the old mill tower. He'd said he wanted to check on something the builders had mentioned, but she knew he just needed to be alone for a while. Like everyone else who had been involved during Ashcroft's initial murder spree, Laura was feeling the strain of being constantly on guard. No one with a connection to Rowan Jackman or Marie Evans was safe. Her heart went out to the tall, brooding figure in the twilight. No one felt the gravity of the situation more than her darling Jackman. Added to this was a further problem that police work wouldn't fix. In her time as a forced psychologist, she had occasionally come across this complication, an irrational fear, but no less serious for that. She needed to nip it in the bud before it escalated, but for once she didn't know how. She was too close to Jackman, and it's impossible to be impartial when someone you love is concerned. Laura let out a soft sigh. She had to do something. Of course. She'd do what she always did when a tough case or an unusual client bothered her. She'd consult with Sam Page, her old tutor and dear friend. Sam would know how to proceed. While she pondered all this, she saw Jackman take his phone from his pocket and hold it to his ear. He suddenly stiffened. After a few moments, he ran back to the house and burst in through the door.
"There's been another shooting, Laura, in town. I have to go."
He paused, looked anxiously at her.
"Lock up immediately after I've gone. Don't answer the door to anyone, and ring me if there's the slightest hint of something not being right."
"Darling, please, I'll be careful, I promise. Now, go." He was already pulling on his jacket and snatching the car keys from their hook.
"I'll be back as soon as I can, but I'll ring first, so you know that it's me coming in."
A hasty kiss, and he was gone. Laura locked the door, made sure the windows were all fastened, and sat down at the kitchen table to call Sam Page. Marie and Gary had managed to enjoy 3/4 of an hour of being ordinary before the call came. Marie paid for their meal, and they jogged back to the house to pick up Gary's car. They were at the crime scene in 20 minutes.
"Who would shoot a homeless guy?" asked Marie incredulously. Jackman narrowed his eyes. "I'm beginning to formulate a theory, but it's too vague to share just yet. The main thing is to identify him."
He glanced over to the ambulance.
standing with its blue lights intermittently illuminating patches of the darkened waste ground. Kevin says the others reckon that the man hadn't been homeless for long, and that he was terrified of something.
"Does he have a name yet?" Marie asked.
"Barney," said Jackman shortly. And Kevin, who, by the way, is very caught up over this, said that he had a rucksack with him, and he kept hold of it as if it contained the crown jewels. He pointed to a blood-spattered bag, still clasped in the dead man's hand. "I had a sneaky look before forensics arrived, and I made a surprising find."
"Yes, and?"
Marie asked impatiently. "A gun."
"What?"
she exclaimed.
"What kind of gun?"
"A Ruger Speed 6 revolver."
Why did that sound familiar?
Marie screwed up her eyes, trying to remember, and then it came to her.
"They were what we used before they were phased out and replaced by the Glock 17 pistol."
"Well remembered, Marie, but it wasn't only the police. The military used them too. The question is, what was Barney here doing with a loaded gun?" Jackman stared down at the body. Marie exhaled.
"No wonder he was hanging onto that bag."
Gary came across to join them. "I've been talking to Kevin Stoner. Apparently it happened while he was talking to the guy. He's well shaken up, boss." "I know. I've spoken to him myself. I've suggested he takes a few days' leave, but knowing him, he'll go home, down a couple of vodkas and be back in tomorrow."
"What was he doing off duty in this godforsaken place, Gary?" asked Marie.
"Trying to help out Charlie Button. He was looking for street gossip on the Red Diesel theft. There's a homeless guy hangs out here that he talks to regularly. It was pure fluke that Barney was shot while he was with him." "Or was it?" Marie glanced at Jackman and knew he was asking himself the same question.
"I suppose the shot was intended for Barney and not for Kevin?"
"I'd say this marksman is a crack shot and he wouldn't have taken out the wrong target. No, Marie, I'm certain he got the right guy. And then there is that revolver." Jackman nodded at the rucksack. Uniform had brought in some halogen lamps and set them up in the area around the body. The very bright lights threw the rest of the scene into total blackness. It was strangely otherworldly, almost dreamlike. Gary nodded to where the emergency vehicles were parked. "Forensics are here." Spike, equipment bags in both hands, was hurrying towards them.
"Sorry you've got me again. Prof Wilkinson says we have another of our sniper's victims, sir."
He looked towards the blood-soaked body.
"Oh my, he's not wrong, is he?"
"Afraid not, Spike. We could use your expertise again. I need to know where the shooter was standing and whether the same weapon was used. It seems obvious, but I have to have it confirmed," said Jackman. Spike knelt and then looked closely at the wound.
"Well, if it is the same gun, he's changed his ammo.